So what are the qualities, Cole, that make a game fragile, and how do you address fragility during the course of your design process?
Okay, let me think about a good fragile game. You know, I think about Amabel Holland's Northern Pacific as a fragile game. I'm trying to think of a simple one, then we can talk about more complex fragile games, because it demands something from the players. It could demand a lot of different things. I mean, a fragile game doesn't even necessarily have to demand that players play well, but it demands something. And if the players don't do that, something about the game doesn't work anymore. And that could also be a lot of things. This is a very open question. This is a very open answer to your question, but it's because I think by having it open, you can see what the stakes are of it. So when you're playing Northern Pacific, there's a very delicate tempo balance as players are choosing where they want to invest. I think Matilda's Turncoats is also like this, where it has like this very, there's a very delicate balance at play. But if the players don't opt into it, the whole thing falls apart. It's like showing up without knowing the script or something, right? Or in a more basic form, I mean, play is oftentimes about a kind of consensual rules enforcement. And when one player doesn't want to play by the same rules as everyone else is playing, then the whole act of play falls apart. And where fragility comes into it is when there are certain, let's say, kind of guidelines that float above the rules that might be unspoken, which are almost just as important as the rules themselves. So, a more complex game, I think about this, is like Dune is an incredibly fragile game. And it's fragile in a really peculiar way, which is if the players who are really strong in a game of Dune, if they form an alliance and end the game, everything kind of falls apart. Like, the whole tension of the game is depending upon the players who are strong having the narcissism to believe that they can win by themselves, and as soon as they stop saying like, you know what, let's just broker a peace, then the whole universe, the whole thing just completely falls apart. And so you always run into people who've played Dune and don't get it, because they're like, yeah, I played Dune, but like it was always over in like three turns. And I'm like, you've like never played Dune. Mm-hmm. You've played by the rules of Dune, but you didn't have sufficiently selfish strong players, which is this like, yeah, one of the weirdest things about Dune is The simpler factions, like the Atreides, the Harkonnen, they oftentimes get given to new players. But actually, like, weirdly, it's the opposite. You want to give the new players the smallest and weakest and strangest factions, because you need the players who are leading the strong factions to be extremely selfish and to behave like their counterparts in the world. So I guess I think about design for fragility in that way. Like, how much are you needing players to opt into in order, mm-hmm, for whatever the game isn't, but here I really mean like the tension, the drama of the scene to work.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because you mentioned both Amabel and Matilda's Turncoats. And one of my first thoughts was how common it is for me to encounter it in negotiation games a bit more, mm-hmm, because the premise of a negotiation game is that we are going to negotiate the points during the game to improve our situation rather than rely on our sound strategy, and I'm such a great tactician or whatever that I can just go around the whole negotiation part. I kind of feel like sometimes in a weird way, American foreign policy sort of feels like it's a negotiation game where this player is not actually going to do any of the negotiation. They just think that they can like sort of, I'll strategize past it. I'll circumvent that portion of it. I don't really have a diplomatic core needed for this particular part of the game. I'm up on points. I'm just going to keep going for the veeps.
This is a whole other conversation, but this is why so oftentimes American foreign policy engages in really complex positions that tries not to kick people out of the game. So like, we don't want to fully cut off someone ever, because, mm-hmm, if we do that, they're not playing the game with us anymore. And so it's much better to maintain any kind of leverage in general. I mean, if you subscribe to that school of thought, which I think I'm increasingly come to, but it's also, it's complex, right? And so like a lot of these times, like, you know, it's so much easier, especially in domestic policy, to have very like hard line political stances. But when you start going out into the, you know, the broader world, you have all these like weird compromise positions.
Yeah. And so that's like an interesting kind of tangle that you're working on, like when you try to make like a diplomacy-based game, like where you're just like, well, how would I keep participants engaged interlocutors till the end of our our session with stakes, right? Yeah, and that does relate to something I'm working on currently. It's a very big question, and like,
yeah,
much more difficult I think than most other kind of design projects that I've tried to like kind of tinker with and mess with. So this might be a little bad segue, but I you had a great thread on Twitter about Napoleon's Last Battles recently, discussing some of the joy of Kevin Zucker's work and going over his writings about balance of simulation and gameplay. You posed a question: where does the designer think the gameplay is for a given game? And I was kind of curious: how do you distinguish between what players learn through the experience of play and what can be gleaned from the model and the system?
Well, I mean, part of this is a liberating thought, but like, you don't, that second question is one that I kind of don't get to answer, right? It's up to the players to figure out what they can pull from it. And this is where I find myself, and this is a term I use a lot when I'm talking about my own work, is like, I just keep thinking about heteroglossia and like the notion that like the things that we create, because they reflect our own intentions, but also the intentions of everything that has influenced us and, you know, huge totemic forces. We can't be even accountable for all of the valences that they might have, right? So, like, I can have ideas of what I want a person to pick up in a certain game, but they're going to find readings that I disagree with, but that aren't less valid because the meaning of the work is getting negotiated and renegotiated. But there is a funny, if I'm thinking about particularly the question about like where is the gameplay found in a particular model? Is that the right way to frame it? It's like a particular episode. I mean, this I think it has to do with how designers I think have to frame their own projects, where they have. I mean, oftentimes when we start game projects, this is something that isn't talked about a lot. Sometimes people think that we start with a game project with like a pithy like marketing, like, ooh, what if wavelength plus animals or like whatever. And there might be some designers that work that way, that can articulate it as like a little marketing pitch. But I find sometimes we're just like after like a weird feeling where you're like, oh, like there's this kind of like mood that I want this game to make. And you don't even like get far enough in the articulation to say much more than like, I think I want players to feel a certain way and to have like a certain sense of a period. And then as you're going through it, you're like, well, okay, like if I want players to be scared, let's say to be kind of be simplistic about it, where's the game to be found in that feeling of being like scared and unnerved, right? And I think about, you know, another design that I've talked about a lot, but like that I've been playing a lot of Blood on the Clock Tower this year, and just thinking about like how that game, I feel like that game was born from people talking about games of Mafia or Werewolf that they had played when they weren't playing them and having these like fond memories. And then they kind of reverse engineered the whole genre from the point of talking about an experience they had. And that, I mean, that sounds like avant-garde, but it's not. That's actually how a lot of design works. I mean, a more banal example is like so many designers working, I think especially who are like, you know, in their 30s, let's say. You know, they grew up playing turn-based strategy games and they're like Windows 95, 98 computers. And they might be trying to like capture, like you might be working on a space game and say like, well, I'm really trying to capture the feeling I had talking with my friends at lunch about playing Masters of Orion. And sometimes when I think about like Twilight Imperium, like that's where that game starts to make sense. Where I'm like, Christian Peterson obviously like loved Masters of Orion 1 and wanted to just like find a way to make it a social experience. Or to, you know, and so I think we're always trying to like recreate these like funny episodes, and sometimes they aren't even episodes of play. They might be like discussions of play or things like that. But then when you're trying to sort and find the actual game, I mean that can be in all kinds of places. And I think it's also possible to work on a subject and have very different feelings about like where the game is. And to that point, the Library of Napoleonic Battles is so interesting because. Surprise, like there are a lot of attempts to figure out how Waterloo should be like modeled or understood. And it is amazing how different they are. And one of the real joys I've found going into Zucker's games is it's reminded me of like wargaming partisanship. Because of course, like some people have their favorite optional rules and other people are like, ah, Zucker, he completely misunderstands this particular element of Napoleonic warfare, and like you actually need to do like a Labatt game, like no, it's not a Labatt. Maybe you want like actually like Herman's understanding of the Hundred Days campaign in his like Waterloo micro game is like better than, you know, Napoleon's Last Gamble or something, and because they are finding the game in like extremely different places. And for my money, I think Zucker's finding the right place, but that's a thing we can talk about.
It's very interesting because I think when I'm learning a game, I have a bit better of a sense of separating what I'm learning from the, and again, right, that's the player creating the meaning, but I can tell what I'm getting from the player experience of playing a game, in part, and what I'm getting from the system, in part because there will be points where, for example, like I'm, you know, reading through the rules for Matilda Simonson and Luke Evison's Count Some Game Jam entry, Hellraisers.
Yeah.
And just, I'm reading the rule book and I got a little smirk on my face. I can feel the smile forming about how these different elements are working, but I haven't played the game yet. I haven't experienced it and felt it yet. So I'm creating a little bit of meaning there and learning something there. And then the actual act of playing it, it's like, that's when you feel the tension or the fear. And I think that it's interesting when I play test designs by new designers, and the way that they sort of cherry pick some of these mechanisms from other games, sometimes there isn't a lot of reflection to the habitat that they were pulled from. Like, why was that thematic there? Because they just like how it made them feel. You know what I mean? It's the nostalgia for like how it made me feel when I played the game, right? Like,
well, and you were talking about what is the like, I find that there are a lot of really good games being made right now, but sometimes, I mean, nothing rose-tinted about my view here. I think that, like, we are in the absolute best period of design that has ever happened. Like, playing games by younger designers right now, I think is incredible. I'm always consistently surprised. But one of the very common things that I see is that kind of weird cherry-picking, and then the result is often interesting, but not cohesive. It like doesn't have like a clear sense, and I wanted, and this is a little bit adjacent to what you just said, but speaking about a game teaching like through its rules and its whatever the materials around the game, and then actually in the play, my favorite example of that recently has been the campaign Levy games, which I feel like I learn so much from reading the history, the card, the excellent play notes, and then when I play it, I'm like, oh, it's weird you can, like, always retreat. I'm like, well, like, obviously, like, if I have a bunch of armies and we've marched on feet and I see you, you know, maybe my visibility is, like, 4 miles. I see you marching towards me and I think, oh, you're a few hours from me. So I'm just going to leave. Like, you can't catch me. We're both walking on feet here. And so the funny, like, and I don't mean to do this to Vogel's work because I adore the campaign levy system. But to me, so much of the campaign levy system has this like funny thing, which is like, do I have time to siege this out before someone's going to come like chase me away? Mm-hmm. And it's this very weird way of thinking about wargaming because the board is very like permeable. You can kind of move wherever you want to move. You may not be able to feed your guys wherever you want to move, but like you can move everywhere. Especially like Amaravid is, I think, hilarious because you're always like deep in each other's territory, always. And then the question is, like, it's as if there is, like an arcade game, like a whack-a-mole, like, ooh, if I just keep, like, hitting this castle, I'm going to get all the victory points. And then I'm like, oh, here comes Dad. And he's, like, marching across the board to me. I'm like, God, break that wall. And I'm like, well, do I want to storm? Like, yeah, let's leave. And then we just, like, pack up and, like, walk away. And that tension has really transformed how I think about medieval warfare. And I didn't fully understand that from reading the rules. Like, it took play for me to really recognize, like, oh, this has to do with, like, kind of how bad these armies were at projecting force. Like, I think one of the things that is so cool about medieval war games is it's such a funny period because the defensive positions were so much greater than the attack capacity of the armies.
Right.
And so it creates like a completely different way of thinking about warfare and like states projecting power at all. And I'm like, oh, of course Europe was a bunch of tiny kingdoms. Like, how could it not be given that like this was the state of play?
That's one of the really interesting things about Justin Fascino's Seljuk that's coming out, is like how he treats it almost like there's a skeleton crew running these garrisons that takes a little bit of effort, you know, added effort to like, oh, I kind of have to scrounge together this lame-o garrison here because I'm over on this other side of the map doing other things. But I always found it fascinating, you know, when I played through Nevsky, like, I'm a terrible, like, logistician. Like, I'm not going to be able to extend supply trains like Friedrich the Great or anything like that. But, like, I felt like I was, you know, when you're in school and you're playing something like Oregon Trail, there's the people who like the role-playing experience of dealing with the different quandaries that come up. And then there's the folks who enjoy doing all the shopping and filling the cart, like loading up the wagon until it can't ford a river anymore. And it's just like very different types of experiences. And I felt like that was the part I was screwing up, was the loading up the carts and...
it's funny because especially in a lot of them, you get a bunch of lordship points and you're like, well... You mean I can just recruit all these troops? Like, I'm going to get more troops than you, and then I'm going to beat you. And you build this big, fat army, and then you're like, oh, no, I can't move. My army's too fat. And you're, like, trying to, like, roll it over a mountain, basically, to get into the enemy. And then you get to the other side of the mountain, and, of course, you're, like, starving out. And it, I think it is just – it. I mean, that's – I think I love operational games so much because, to me, it is just – it's the place where – So, I mean, what's the right way to put it? I mean, I could talk about operational games all day because I think it's the perfect scale for war games because it most closely corresponds to the actual agency of a commander. Whereas in the lower level tactical games, you're really talking about like doctrines. And so like, you know, you're either talking about like doctrines or like movies, right? Where it's, I mean, ASL is my favorite example of that, where ASL, I think, is a very good game about World War II movies. Because it really captures like the like little moments of heroism and little dramatic moments, and then you know, oh god, the factory's on fire, all the smoke is drifting across. Very cinematic game, but we're really talking about like different doctrine, like tactical doctrines in play, and not really about the agency of any particular person. Whereas when you scale up to the grand tactical and the operational, you're like, oh no, there's like a single person making a plan, executing it. And that's like actually like when we think about the places where particular leaders distinguish themselves, it's in that sphere. It's not like at the level of doctrine. Like, you know, at the level of doctrine, the people who distinguish themselves are, you know, the folks engaging in heroics and then like the professors teaching infantry tactics at West Point or whatever.
Sure. Absolutely.
Sorry. I like tactical games, but I don't know how to play them.
Yeah, I think that there's, it kind of came up too, like when I was talking to Kai Jensen about Combat Commander, like we kept coming back to cinema and like this kind of cinematic experience and like, oh, that was really dramatic. Wasn't that fun? Wasn't that tense when this happened type of thing? And it's great to play the same scenario and have drastically different outcomes every single time, but it's certainly emphasizing it, like where the gameplay is there, it's like certainly emphasizing that kind of high drama, like moment to moment, instead of like the individual, you know, decisions that would actually like guide the overall kind of offensives and everything.
There's a really good, sorry, I'm going to interrupt and say, well, there's a really good, there's a really good note in one of the Zucker diaries that I read where he said that like on the day of battle, you know, like Wellington, you'd often see him like running around, making sure his squares were in good line, like darting around the battlefield, and like Napoleon would like take a nap because he had already set up the table, right? And it wasn't that he wasn't a good like commander at the battalion level, which he was, but oftentimes like the actual like core, like where the gameplay was sitting, was at this like operational level.
Yeah. You kind of see, you hear similar things like when you think about Age of Sail games, for example, in terms of like, for the most part, you know, there's a bit of a feel like we form a row, you form a row, we're going to like angle in on each other, exchange broadsides. That'll be fun, right? But so much of it has to do with like the actual crew composition and like what the capabilities are of some of these ships. Sometimes their overall condition, things like that. And so at a certain point, maybe what wins the day is actually fundamentally something that you're kind of incapable of modeling at the scale that you're doing, or is just going to be a little boring for some people. So just like trying to find an interesting way to do it.
Well, this is a great, like, we think about the pursuit of good modeling, good war game design is this discourse that's bigger than one game, takes, you know, generations to figure out. Age of Sail games to me are in such a funny spot because I think they're really hard to do the design work on. I think there are a lot of really good ones. I just played the new Mike Nagel single ship one, like Captain's, what is it called?
Captain C off of Captain Legion.
Which, very good. I love Close Action. I really love Wooden Ships and Iron Men. That game, I played a lot of that game in high school. And I think all those games are good. And his big fleet game, which I'm now also forgetting, the one that GMT published that's also solid, Flying Colors. I think that game is also good. But that isn't really Age of Sail. I mean, like it's seeing a very weird part of it. And I've played 1805 Sea of Glory. That's not the right year, is it? Oh my gosh!
I think that is. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Of course, it has to be the right year, but it sounded wrong. But anyway, I played that and I thought like this is the right line. I don't think that's the game. I don't think that's the system. But it's like getting in the right direction.
Yeah,
and so I'm like, what I want to see is like a generation of iteration on 1805 to like get to the like what is the comprehensive operational scale for naval combat, which is why I was so interested in like what Jeremy White was doing with Atlantic Chase and starting to just think about like how do you actually handle this is a scattered answer, but to me they're like one of the things that games really struggle with is something like double blind play. I think it's like impossible for board games to do it really well. And the problem with naval games is like they have to be double blind. Like they only make sense. Like that whole genre, like you like almost need it to be double blind. And so I think it's like a problem that is particularly thorny because it's dealing with like the weakest part of our form. Mm-hmm. I would never like want to even attempt one. I would rather, not knowing anything about like making a video game, I would rather someone say, go make an Age of Sail video game than say, make an Age of Sail war game. Yeah. I don't know anything about making video games.
That's actually the only war game I've ever attempted, like a formal war game that I've ever tried to design. Like I worked on one for like a year and it was super fun because I just felt so relaxed because you know you're getting it wrong in a way. Yeah. Like you're just like, what am I going to emphasize? You emphasize that one thing, and then everything else is sacrificed for gameplay to a certain extent. So it's just like we're not doing station keeping, kids. Like it's a Wednesday night. Everyone's got to get home at a certain time, or this isn't going to have a rich bouquet of like reactive movement. Like we're doing something else here. So like, can you feel the wind? Can you feel like some of the basically constraints on command and control? Like you're just trying to like short it up, like kind of cinch it up a little bit. But I feel like if you were going to do the deep dive thing, then you'd just be like, I'm going to do a computer game. This is going to preserve like that blindness and like make it the glorious mess that I envision in my head and like the game I dream about. But
well, I really wanted to make, it's funny you say it because I have an operational Age of Sail game that I attempted many years ago and I couldn't get it to work. And it was entirely about, Admiral Suffren, the French admiral, and the French admiral's very successful campaign against the British off the coast of India in the 17, like during the I think it was in the 70s and 80s. I couldn't get it to work. It was a mess. It was always so far from working. I never even like really talked about it, but it was a weird half design. We need more games about like weird small naval engagements.
Yeah. Anything with a peculiar geography, I'm just like roped in. Ooh, like yes. I just love that. Speaking of peculiar geography, this segue's got
famous
so much promise,
bullet
right?
Transition.
You know, it's kind of interesting. I was reading one of Dan Thoreau's essays about Pax Premier's second edition, and he was commenting on the change in language from empire to coalition, and how he felt it kind of reframed the second edition's focus on local politics. And I was kind of taken with that because, to me, the focus was already on local politics, but maybe that's because just the game state itself, like the way the table state was like laid out, the center of the table is the evolving state of these coalitions on a map of Afghanistan. But immediately in front of the players is the tableau of cards with the small little print, the little abilities, and all the artwork facing them. It felt to me like the local was already emphasized because it's closer to me on the table. I was kind of curious, do you think that, like, in that spirit, because it's a very, very peculiar geography that with that specific game I think about a lot, and it's definitely, like, influenced things that I'm working on, like, now, but do you think that there was, like, a conscious shift in the second edition, or did you just kind of re-emphasize, try to improve the clarity of what was already there?
I mean, I thought about it as improving the clarity of what was already there, because I thought Pax Mir was always a game about local politics, fundamentally. And, it like, even though they went from being called empires to coalitions, they're always it's the same thing in terms of the game space. But what I found was, and I think this is like part one of the weird lessons I've had to learn in my history games, is that hard to be subtle in a game design. Hard, like, you have to really, I think you just really have to, like, kind of call things out by the exact name that you want them to be called. And I think, you know, Pamir, the first edition, was my very first published design, and I think I was being, like, a little too, like, coy with some of the argumentation. And so when I got around to the second edition, I was like, I mean, that was one of the very first things I changed. I was like, oh, because I kept like reading game reports and being like, wow, these people are really, like, misunderstanding what was the game's modeling. And that is my fault. And I think that I can just sort of, like, slightly just the frame a little bit. I mean, I think, you know, my favorite example of that is people who would ask me about Pax Vermeer and colonization. Like, which, you know, in my academic brain, I'm like, can you repeat the question? Are you asking me about the British colonization of Afghanistan? Can you tell me when that happened? Like, I just don't, yeah. I mean, it's so peculiar. And I think what is happening is folks are coming to a game. I don't think I appreciated the weight of the preconceptions. You know, you're coming to a game with, you know, oh, this game is about the British Empire. So what I imagine in my brain is, you know, if someone says the game is about the British Empire, I'm like, oh, Kipling. You know, like, I saw Gandhi when I was a high schooler. This game must be about that. And Pax Vermeer is, like, not really about that at all. Like, I mean, it is, I mean, I, in fact, like, even, I mean, I use the notion of the British Empire, even the second edition, even though we're really talking about the East India Company, but we're also talking about the East India Company in this transitional period where it is so tied up with the emerging British Empire that I'm like, well, I should just call it the British Empire because that's kind of how it's behaving a little bit. But even that is, like, right on the edge of, like,
sure.
It is sort of irresponsible to call it the British Empire. And so what was happening is I was running into these, like, and part of this is Phil's fault for writing that essay about British colonialism, which is, like, extra out of, but it's a very weird instance because I feel like Phil wrote, like, what I regard to be a kind of a misinformed essay, but then a bunch of people in engaging with Phil's essay, like, took the bait because they're like, Phil wrote an essay that didn't have anything to do with Pax Vermeer. And so whenever someone talks about Phil's essay, that's fine. They're welcome to. But they're not talking about Pax Vermeer. They're now, like, 2 degrees away from it. And so I think when it came to the second edition, I was like, okay, I want to make sure we're framing this stuff very clearly, which is also why, you know, I had thought about – I spent a lot of time thinking about if the game should have footnotes and if it should have essays, what kind of essays should it have? Because I've written a lot about Pamir, and I thought, like, okay, well, I could really explain everything and, like, do the kind of very Eklundian, like, this is the argument of the game. And I thought, well, no, that's, like, I don't know, it's tacky. It also, like, I think it shortchanges the game, it shortchanges the audience a little bit. So, like, instead, what if I do this, like, guided lit review, which is how I got the, like, the reading X, reading Y style essays that I put at the end. And the whole point of the Pamir essay is like, I mean, it was really a reaction to seeing people react to Phil's writing. Like that is why that essay is shaped the way it is. Because what I wanted to do is say, okay, you need to know that when you are, like anybody who's written about the great game is sort of like writing about something else. And it's important to realize the degree to which your own subject position changes how you're using the past. And this is like, I had a little history lit study project this summer where I was just reading a bunch of biographies of Alexander the Great, thinking about like the historiography of Alexander the Great. And it took an embarrassingly long time. It actually took me reading Briant's work, the French guy Pierre Briant, I think is his name, the Shadow, Alexander and the Darius and the Shadow of Alexander, an amazing book, which is this this attempt to write a history, a biography of King Darius III, the king that Alexander toppled, who was like, at the time of his life, most powerful figure in the world, but we don't know anything about him because he got toppled by Alexander. So all that we know about him is the boot that is on his head, basically.
Yeah.
And that book and his whole career is really about the historiography of Alexander. And one of the things that he really brought to mind is like, actually, like the degree to which we like care about Alexander the Great has a lot to do with the fact that the Romans cared about Alexander the Great. And so like our whole like sense of him and his role is really like the Romans saying, this guy was ace, we're kind of like this guy now. Like, you know, in the same way, imagine if everything that we knew about George Washington was from stuff written by, like, neocons in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. If, like, the only surviving biography of George Washington was, like, the Bill O'Reilly, autobiography of George Washington. That's essentially what we've got with Alexander. I mean, obviously, there are other primary sources, it's more complicated historiography, but suddenly I had this moment where I was like, wow, it's amazing the degree to which we understand something is actually about these like these lenses that are so much closer to the subject than they are to our own moment. We forget that we're not looking at the subject, we're looking at a lens looking at the subject. And so with Pamir, I just kind of wanted to say like, look, I have a lens that I'm using to read this moment, and a lot of people who read it in different ways, they have lenses too, and this is just what it means to encounter the past.
That raises a great question, Cole. I'm kind of curious. So when you're doing research for a design, do you focus almost exclusively on recent historiography on your topics, or do you try to get a little bit more of a gamut to sort of view how it's been covered in the past as well as like how it's being covered in a contemporary context?
That's a good... No one's ever asked me that question before, Dan. Let me think about that, because the game, I think it's very hard for a game to, unless the subject of the game is historiography itself, it's very difficult for a game to like what they used to say in rhetoric was like teaching the debate. I think it's just very hard for a game to do that. I think that you can kind of do it. And actually, wargaming is probably better appointed to it than others, where you can be like, hey, we have two different reasons why we think this thing happened. We're going to use the game to show how, like, maybe it could be one or the other. But also, like, you always wonder, sometimes I feel like I do see that kind of thinking in wargaming, and I always feel like the designer has an opinion. They know. Because they privilege something in their design that is explaining it. In my own reading, I read widely, which is to say, like, when I was working on Pamir, I read historians that I disagreed with, that I thought were very wrong about how we should understand the Anglo-Afghan War. And in John Company, I like spent a lot of time with Niall Ferguson and with like the new imperial apologists, and like really tried thinking about like how they understand the rise of the East India Company. But I have to make a decision about which things I think are right. And there's also like, I think there's a tendency sometimes to find like what the most like current understanding is and then just assume that it's right because it just happened to like only come out last year or something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm trying to think about the books that I reference, like, you know, like the Anarchy and the Thor book, Inglourious Empire, right? That's what that's called.
Yeah, I just finished it. It's excellent.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, isn't it good?
Excellent.
It's good.
Yes.
So, like, it's good, and the Dalrymple book is very good. I also think that, like, Inglourious Empire has some problems. I think it, like, kind of, like, falls into some traps that earlier historians didn't fall into. And so what ends up resulting is, like, I pull from a lot of historians. Some of the books are, like, pretty old. Like, some of the books I read on the history of Parliament were, like, from the 50s. But they just, like, that was the best book I could find on the East India Company and its effect on Parliament. So I'm like, you know, or like the one I always think about for Pamir is, you know, so for Pamir, again, Dalrymple was really useful. Although Dalrymple has a weird relationship to Pamir because I read Return of a King after I finished the game. It's just like I just hadn't gotten to it. And so a lot of the like theories in Pamir were based on C.A. Bailey's work, who I think he died a few years ago, but he's like a titan. Like he is one of the best people for understanding how the British Empire worked in India ever. And in some ways, very an old fashioned historian. And the other one is there's a book on politics by this guy named Yap from like 1980 or something like that. And it's just about understanding British politics on the Northwest frontier, which is to say Afghanistan, so Northwest from India. And it's incredible. It's like one of the best researched, just like sober accounts of what guided British decision making. And it just happens to have been written by like the most dusty Oxford Don type person that you could have. but you sort of never know where that stuff's going to sit. Right. So, you know, I think, you know, when I was in graduate school, I was a fellow at in this like weird study center called British Studies, which was directed by this guy named Roger Lewis, who is he's one of those people who, I think he's like a knight, right? He's like an OBE knight. He had written and edited like 100 books on the British Empire. And you did this very funny thing every week, which I came to really, really like, where basically you cosplayed as Oxford in the 1960s. He would like have some author and everybody would like wear a suit jacket. You had to like dress up to go to this event. You'd have sherry. And then you'd have a little talk, and it was very intimate. I mean, we'd have really major writers. I mean, I met C.A. Bailey at one of these things. And there'd be 30 people in the room, maybe 40 on a busy day. You would ask questions, things like that. And it would seem old-fashioned, but one of my other professors that I had, this woman named Barbara Harlow, who is this, like, brilliant, like, one of the, brilliant post-colonial thinker, like, one of the top thinkers around. Sadly, she passed away a few years ago. And she always told me, like, no, you should go to these British studies events because they have really good speakers. And they're actually, you know, they, like, Bailey's a good example of someone who looks like a stuffy old white dude. When you look at his work, it's like, oh, your work is synthesizing a lot and doing a lot of very interesting, making a lot of interesting arguments that are building on current research that otherwise you might have missed. And so actually, like, I think... When I got past the pretenses of the fact that it wasn't like the most fashionable place to be on a Friday on campus, actually there were really interesting conversations happening there that brought me into contact with like a huge body of scholarship that I would have never run into otherwise.
That's really cool. I was going to say, I think it's very difficult to try to synthesize these things. Like, you can see how you'd synthesize the new and the old. Historiography in writing a little bit more easily than how you would do that in a game that didn't have a very confusing ludonarrative, I guess. Right? Like, I suppose, you know, to your earlier point, like a war game, for example, that if we have a game about, I don't know, the Battle of the Virginia Capes, right? And there's these two different theories on whether or not the British are essentially going to lose this naval engagement off the coast of the Chesapeake because, like, they are last minute going to have some confusion over some signals that were sent, and then suddenly now they reverse the line, and then the rear fleet is like separating from everyone else. I can create an optional rule that says that that didn't happen, or like change basically like what the order of battle is going to be. And I think that in a weird way, all these optional rules, it's not just like how much detail do you want to take, but I think some designers actually use that to help kind of incorporate like this counter argument into their actual thesis of like, well, what if that didn't happen? Or here's one reading of this event, and then this is what's going to create this new kind of command restraint, like constraint. But it's difficult, right?
Well, I was just going to say. It reminds me of the again. I'm like, I keep coming back to Zucker, who like I'm just reading all of Zucker's design writing right now. I just kind of started at the beginning of the earliest thing I could find. I'm just going through it. But he has this amazing thing that he does in his war games, which is that usually he has like the day of battle scenario, which kind of sets the troop deployments up how they were, and then he always has an approach to battle, which starts a few hours earlier, sometimes a day earlier, and the day of battle. I find them kind of boring because they usually just play out how the battle plays out. But the approach to battle is fascinating because you can make some decisions. You can do weird, weird, weird things. And that, to me, starts to capture like the possibility of the moment. I ran to this line when I was reading one of his essays a few days ago where he said that like the most accurate thing in a design is like the roll of a die. Like you can't be more accurate in the moment where something doesn't go the way it was supposed to go. And so I think a lot of my designs, I mean, I would have never guessed that this would be like a pillar of my own design practice, but finding that pretty much all of my designs like engage with risk because you like, I think if you're trying to tell a story that is like the moment, or really, I mean, I think most drama has this too. Like you really do need to like engage with risk. Because if you did, and the degree to which you stop engaging with risk is the world where we're moving like towards the puzzle, or towards like something that is very different from like the game, the moment, the kind of sweep of history.
Kind of connecting with Zucker's point about the approach to battle, because having not read any of Zucker's work, I think a lot about Rachel Simmons' old design blog on the Simmons game site, which sounds like biblical for me, getting me into design and trying not to be so trash at it. And I think about how the reputation her games like Bonaparte Marengo and Napoleon's Triumph have is being like you have full control over all these elements. And then when we get to battle, there's sort of a chaos because of everything we don't know. Yeah, but it's just the chaos of everything we don't know. But when she pivoted to Guns of Gettysburg, and as for the first time really experiencing like this American Civil War game where I have to like dick around and wait for generals to show up with reinforcements at places and like find out like what, you know, artillery tokens I'm drawing, it was a very alien experience within the context of a Rachel Simmons game.
Yes.
But to your point, that was that. I felt like there was like sort of this eye-opening thing, like where she is like sort of like had this aha, you know, a moment, like this design epiphany of like, this is the uncertainty that is needed to make this feel kind of more, I don't know, more at heart, like what she was trying to model for that particular, for Gettysburg, like was like just like this sense of like this anticipation and not knowing who's going to come when and everything like that.
Well, this is—I mean—the thing that I one of the things I like about these Zucker Napoleonic games is that sometimes it rains, or like there's a thunderstorm and all the streams are swollen and you like can't cross and you're like, well, do I wait 3 hours? Like three turns or whatever. So like you'll have these weird dead turns where you're like, yeah, I think I just need to kind of wait, and like that's it. That's like that's the waiting, right? And I think. It's funny how I feel like that. The more banal parts of military engagements, that's what makes them special, because it captures the degree to which we don't get to be, you know, fully in control of anything. This is actually something, you know, another a very different kind of game than the ones we've talked about. There's Mark McLaughlin's The Napoleonic Wars is like my favorite card-driven war game, and I think that the design is. It's like kind of a mess of a design. Like I really hope he does a second edition sometimes. I do think, like, there is a second edition, but I hope that GMT, like, does a third edition or, like, a 2.5, because it's just, like, a little, there are things, I mean, it's messy in a way that, like, there are things that are cards that shouldn't be cards. There are things that are not cards that should be, you know, it's like a classic, like, early CDG, like, I would love someone to take another whack at it. But the thing that it does that I haven't played any other CDG that really captures this is it is so crazy. It feels like the craziest things happen to that. I'm going to, like, recruit the Swedes and as the French. I'm going to land them on Ireland and start a rebellion. And now the Brits have to decide, like, do we send Wellington to the peninsula or do we send him to Ireland? It gets so ahistorical. And so my friends would sometimes call it, like, Napoleon the arcade game.
Sure.
But what I love about it is it captures the spirit of, like, capital R romantic possibility. Like, this is Beethoven's Eroica. This is, like, anything can happen. And the game is so good at, like, putting you in a position and saying, like, look, part of what, if you want to understand the behavior of the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, et cetera, coalitions, you need to understand that they were living in a period where, you know, the king is dead, and, like, Louis's dead, and it seems like anything is possible. And I think McLaughlin's Napoleonic Wars captures it, like, really beautifully. And it has to do with, like, how permissible the game is, but also, like, it random things happen. And the game is very good at having players, experience losses of control. In the way that, like, I think, you know, the Guns of Gettysburg, the drawing of Artillerychits is a great example, too. Because so much of bombardment is, like, hoping to get lucky. Especially in, like, 19th century warfare.
Well, you think, like, future edition could kind of temper some of the craziness, but preserve enough of it
for a new audience? Yeah, I just want it cleaned up a little bit. Like, it has like a rule, but I mean, it's just one of those that I take it out every once in a while to play it because I do really like the game, and I'm always struck with, like, I wish this could just get a little cleaned up.
Yeah,
like, I think that, like, the map is very nice, but, like, it could use a new map. It could use nicer pieces. It is just one of those things that, like, if I had all world enough in time, I'm like, I would do a redraw of that game because I think it could be one of the best card driven games. And, like, I would love it to get, you know, the same treatment that, like, that Successors got with the Phalanx edition. Mm-hmm. And I actually think the GMT Successors is super nice. There's no shit on that edition. But the Phalanx one is making a real effort to sell that game to people who aren't, like, GMT mainstays.
Yeah. They can wear their usurper ring to work on casual Friday. Yeah. Kiss the ring. Yeah, man. Hey, I got another philosophical question.
Ooh,
I'm not
going to
be graceful at all.
Now I'm loosened up.
Yeah. I was going to say, above all else, what do you look for in a second edition when you're approaching that for one of your designs?
So the process that Drew and I do, and it's really collaborative, is we always ask ourselves if the game was the best version of itself. This sounds so trite, but, like, it's important to start by saying that isn't the question that's usually asked of second editions. Usually second editions, you're like, this game came out a long time ago. We would like to modernize it, which is another way of saying we would like to sell more, right? So that, to me, is one big reason why second editions happen. And that explains D&D from, like, second edition to third edition. And there's a reason why I'm picking second edition and third edition. Now, the other thing that can happen in second editions is when there is so much supplementary material, it's clear that the core chassis of the game wasn't strong enough to hold all that supplemental material. So you kind of have to, like, recodify everything. And that's D&D from first edition to second edition, right? Mm-hmm. Second edition D&D, to me, is, which is my first edition of the game that I played, was the second edition. And I found it so difficult to understand, but I found it hard to understand because I had never played AD&D or BD&D. I'd never played, like, the weird earlier forms. So I didn't appreciate the fact that the second edition was saying, we are gathering all that material together and we are going to, like, harmonize it in the same way that from squad leader to advanced squad leader, which is really like a first edition to a second edition, at least in my the way I tend to think about it. To me, advanced squad leader is one of the great editorial achievements in game design. We usually make fun of it because the rulebook's really long. But like, what it did was say, like, look at this giant body of work, and we're going to put it into one form. And then the fact that the game has lived for, you know, 40 years or whatever, to me is a real testament to the strength of that. Like, I mean, it was like the printing of the Oxford English Dictionary or something, right? And so, you know, there are these two ways of thinking about second editions, which is like, again, are you codifying something and trying to like rebuild the foundations, or are you trying to modernize it so you can sell it to a wider audience? I don't do either of those things. What I do is I look at the game and I say, is this actually the best version of this game? And that like kind of brings me to a general design approach, which is when I'm working on a game, I have like an argument, I have an idea of like, you know, and this idea could be intuitive, it could have to do with like the mood, it could have to do with how I want players to talk about the game when they're not playing it. But that idea is the game. And over the course of development, things like mechanisms, I don't care. Like, I will work on a mechanism for 6 months and then throw it away in an instant if it's not working to me. And that can be frustrating to playtesters, especially earlier on in my career, where they were like, I signed up to do a deck builder and you've turned it into a worker placement game. And I'm like, no. We're building something that is more than a deck builder. The deck builder is just a means to the end here. And so, you know, that sense of what a game is, that doesn't go away necessarily when a game is published. So when I looked at Pamir, I kind of said, well, I had an idea of what I wanted Pamir to be. And I don't think the published version of the first edition of Pamir is what that is. And so what I'm going to do is ask myself, what do I really want this thing to be? And then I'm going to build it. And so, you know, Pamir was interesting because I had some testers in Austin who we had when we were first working on Pamir. The first, like, two or three times that we playtested together, these were my very first playtest sessions where I was working on a game, really. I'd worked on other projects before that, but this is the first time where I was like, it was my thing. And they were great games. They were so fun. And then something about the development of the game stole something of that spirit. And I was happy with how Pamir turned out, but it, like, just wasn't quite what I had imagined. And so, you know, Drew and I just started really playing Pamir and thinking about, like, well, we wanted this to be an accessible PAX game. We wanted it to, like, hit these narrative bits to like, really be about, like, coalition forming and breaking and about, like, diplomatic inertia. And also we wanted to tell this story of state formation. Let's bring those things to the surface and then cut out the stuff that doesn't fit. And so I remember I sat down. One of the first things that I did when I was working on the second edition Pamir is I just rewrote the rules from memory. So I'm not going to look at a Pamir rulebook. I'm just going to retype them, fresh document. And what I found was after I had rewritten the rules, they were half as long because I had rearranged them. I was better at writing rules. And then also I had like this weird third of the document that I was like, I don't think I like any of this stuff. And so I was like, okay, well, now we can start working on the second edition. Now, what's interesting is I think this confuses people because when I got to John Company, I looked at John Company and I was like, well, John Company got too simplified. That I wanted to make this like almost role-playing game, this like giant universe. And instead, I made something that was like, I think, an over-articulated negotiation euro. In the first edition, which oftentimes was like too clever for its own good by half. And so getting back to the question of like being explicit in the design, the second edition of John Company was about like, well, let's be explicit about what this game is doing at every step. I mean, there were, for instance, I would have people tell me after they played John Company, the first edition, they didn't fully realize that it was about India. And like, I'm like, well, that's crazy. But if I sympathize with them for a second, I'm like, yeah, I mean, I guess there's no map of India. There's like, no, like, you know, if you didn't know that, like, you know, Gujarat is like kind of near the Sindh or whatever, like you might miss some of that stuff. And so going into John Company, I like wanted to give it like that expanse. So like in Pamir's instance, it was really about like, filing down and making something like simpler, a little more accessible, and in John Company's example, more concise. And in John Company's, it was like, no, I actually need to like build it out. And then this approach, it has consequences at every single level of design development. So like, Drew and I do all of our own product design too. And so with Pamir, I mean, one of the first conversations Drew and I had Pamir was like, how big should the box be? Because Phil's boxes are all based on, like, German postage rates circa 2008. That was, like, his whole business model was, like, built on a very narrow, like, it's got to be under a kilogram. If we fit it this way, I can, like, fit it in this size packet, which I respect. I mean, I just got one of Daniel Newman's, like, New Mill Industries games. And their whole business model is built around, like, the small priority mailbox. Because the games always fit in them. And that's cool, but I kept thinking, like, well, what if I allowed the game to answer that question? Like, how big should the game be? And I'm like, well, Drew and I started thinking about Avalon Hill Bookcase games and just how much we liked, like, the profile of what we think of as, like, a war game box these days. And then, you know, well, then how big should the rule book be? Like, how should the pieces be? How can we create, like, hierarchies of importance? Like, John Gumby's actually an interesting example there, because we spent a lot of money on... all the stuff in India costs a lot of money. That was, like, where we commissioned the art. We had little metal flags. We got the domes and towers. A lot of the game's budget is tied up in India. And I'm like, well, that feels right, because, like, that's where the money came from. And so, like, I want to, you know, so I was, like, finding ways in the production to kind of fulfill the broader vision of the game. So, you know, what I look for in a second edition as a consumer is totally different from what I look for as a designer. And generally, I will say, as a consumer, I don't really like second editions, because mostly to me, they have to do with selling games, and they usually don't reckon with the things that made the game interesting, at least to me, to begin with.
Hmm. I mean, personally, like, now coming at this from the designer angle, I can't wait for a second edition to, like, eradicate, or a second attempt to, like, try to reconcile some of the challenges from designing the game the first time. In a weird way, you, even if you operate without proper development, I would say, to put it diplomatically, I think that there's something to be said for just having released it in the wild and get an input of, like, what is being misread by players.
Yep.
Or not misread. That makes it seem like they're misinterpreting something more that sure. I'm not putting across with the clarity that I should have, like, something that I want them to understand. And then to your earlier point, like, when you're talking about the, you know, players not necessarily perceiving that this is set in India, there's, you know, like, when I was working in 1979, I refer to the Shah throughout this rule book, but it's just Reza Pahlavi on the card. It never even dawned on me that someone would not know who the Shah was, like, which sure, is just yes. like, That's how immersed you are in having read about a thing for 2 years. Just like, oh my God, I did not go broad enough. I didn't think about these things.
Like, the bait, yeah.
I didn't explain this. And just, like, you kind of realize you're in this weird, like little silo, and you just can barely see outside.
I've forced myself on my rule books to, like, do that first page introduction. It's usually, like, three or four short paragraphs long, where I'm like, I need to explain this. Like, just very clear, like, if you know nothing else, please, I always tell people, like, don't skip the dang first page of the rule book, because it is not flavor text. It is explaining the context of the game, and you, like, need it. Otherwise, you're not going to know who the Shah is, and the whole thing is going to fall apart. No, it is such a, it is a crazy privilege to be able to do second editions. Like, that is not, like, a super... I'm glad it seems to be becoming a little bit more normal, like, you know, but I think having an audience who said, like, and we were so worried about with Premiere, which is why with every second edition, I have the rule that I'm like, people always ask me, I mean, you kind of have to do a funny two-step, right? I'll tell people, like, proud of my work, and I can recognize that people can prefer it to the new work. That's fine. But personally, the second edition is better. So, like, I have not played Premiere First Edition in years. I'm not interested in playing it. I played it a long time ago. But, and, like, the exact same thing is true for John Company. And I know that there are some people who will say, well, John Company First Edition is better. I'm like, well, that's fine. You can say that. I don't agree with you. And I'm very clear that, like, I mean, Drew and I, the biggest rule that we have is, speaking personally, the second edition has to be better than the first edition. Because if it's not, then you've got a mess. Then you've got people trying to get the weird early edition with the cool wood piece, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And so the thing I always feel like the base thing that I owe to my audience is, when it comes to my own preferences, I have to be able with a straight face to say and to believe, and for it to be true personally, for the second edition to be better than the first. But the other thing I'll add to this conversation is that, like, you also can't help but make second editions. Like, every design I've ever worked on is, like, a direct reaction to the previous game. So, like, I had all these problems with Root, which, like, in Oath is, like, a direct, like, okay, here are all my problems with Root, working them out in Oath. And now that I'm working on Arx, it's, like, all my problems with Oath, working them out in Arx. And they're, so, like, you know, Root may not get a second edition ever. It's hard to know. I mean, that's a whole separate conversation we talk about, because it is really different. It just involves the different scales and things. But if people want to know, like, what does Root 2 look like, I'm like, I don't know, play Oath and play Arx. Like, I'm on Root 3 personally, because I'm working on Arx right now.
Do you, in principle, do you cross the streams a little bit? Like, you think about the leader stream and then, like, the Whirling Gig stream. I'm just kind of curious, is there a little bit of when you're conceiving of your second edition of Infamous Traffic that's a reaction to Arx, as weird as that sounds?
Well, so there are very funny ways where they do cross. So, for example, Pamir's second edition was one of the things it was reacting to was Root, in particular, like, how the files, like, the back-end stuff, like, how the files and production stuff were. I mean, I just learned so much working on Root, and I was like, oh, knowing what I know now, this is the way to rebuild, you know, to rebuild Pamir. And then the design, there are weird implications. So, like, for example, but here's an even stranger one. So I worked a lot on Vast the Mysterious Manor. It's like my weird, like, B-side, you know? And I really adore that game and care about it. And that was the game that taught me how to do good card design. Because Root, I was too scared. I was like, I was so happy with the core of Root. I was like, I don't want to break this game with special effect cards. So my special effect card design in Root was very conservative. So it, like, worked, but it never did anything radical. And then when we were working on Mysterious Manor, I was like, oh, well, what if we got a little stranger with this card design? What if we did something that was that just, like, really was a lot more, I don't know the right way to put it, but, like, a little more forward with like, what if I just trusted players better and also built enough development time to allow for stranger gameplay impacts? And then that influenced Pamir a little bit, because I was finishing Pamir at the time. So some of the special effect cards in Pamir were very much me, like, thinking through that question in a mysterious manner. But then when I got to John Company, the laws in John Company have a lot to do with, like, learning card design in a mysterious manner and then an Oath, and saying, like, okay, like, if you're going to have an effect card in John Company, it's got to do something. And I think, you know, it's so funny. This is another place where when I run into people who prefer the first edition of John Company, I'm like, have you not looked at the law decks? The law deck in John Company 2 is so much cooler. It, like, every card is wild and can really change how the game works, whereas the law cards in John Company First Edition are very muted. So there's always, like, it's rarely on the high-level stuff. it has a lot to do with, like, the individual mechanisms, like the more workman part of design.
Fascinating. That's really interesting.
Yeah, they're all bound together. But I have a very, like, I compartmentalize highly. I go to work, and usually Drew and I will have a meeting at, like, 8 a.m., so I'll get to work, we'll have a very quick meeting, and I'll say, all right, I'm off to Leaderland. And then Drew and I have a debrief at, like, 5 at the end of the day. And then on the weekends, I actually do, like, tomorrow is my day for working on WhirlyGig stuff, so I'll be working on that. But I try to keep the very, very separate.
Something that came to mind is interesting. When we were talking a bit about historiography and, like, how it, you know, influences our research process for games, as well as kind of what we... what we choose to incorporate so we can have a design that's coherent to mm-hmm. players. There's, like, an interesting... I was watching Scorsese talk about Paul and Pressburger a little bit, oh, yeah. Matter of Life and Death.
I love that
and
movie.
And he reflected on the film as though... He said... What was his quote? He said it was the most wonderful kind of propaganda or something along those lines. Because he's talking about this, like, kind of renewal of something about it, like a bit of a renewal or revival of English culture in the wake of the Second World War, mm-hmm. you know, type of thing. And I was thinking about how some designers, when they cover cover a given topic, but they use a lot of what I feel are kind of old sources, and there's not a lot of new historiography in it. There's a little nugget of that, and then there's these new designers that have this, God bless them, this little bit of a, they get like a little, you know, they get a little bug, they get like their everything like in a little wad, and then it's just like a thing like, I'm gonna use all the new stuff, and I'm gonna be hard hitting, I'm gonna be abrasive, and so then they approach their game topics with this sort of like a Michael Haneke type of like a sequence shots. I'm going to be very, like very deliberate, and I'm going to have a little bit of banality nestled in with this just unnerving, very unsettling, like, you know, kind of play experience. And I think in film, you have this barrier between the audience and the medium that you're trying to get, you're trying to trick the audience in some cases to forget about it. And you bring it closer by having a little bit of tedium, or having the shot that isn't, it's not sexy. It's just sort of like like a 7-minute sequence shot that's just like unbroken, where it's like, you kind of forgot you're watching a film there for a second.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes the newer designers, myself included, by the way, because I definitely like to poke people, is we forget how immersive games are by comparison.
Yeah.
And the experience of play, sometimes when you're rubbing people the wrong way, it's so much more impactful than you think of it when you're looking at it at the design table, I think.
Well, this is a place where I'm really finding my own approach to be a little different than the approach that you might have, or the other person I think about a lot in this context is Amabel. Because she describes her works. I mean, she has a really, she's written about this a bunch. She sometimes talks about her history games, especially the ones that are political and social, as not being history games, but being polemics. And that's a powerful form of art, but that is probably the place where I most, just in terms of a personal, aesthetic school, disagree. I'm my games are not polemics. Mm-hmm. I'm not coming at you hard with a single vision. And so I'm I think that I'm kind of straddling a more polemical school and the more model driven school of someone like Herman, where I'm I want to present a space and then let players navigate the space and kind of pull their own polemics from it. But I mean, so, you know, it was funny. You just finished the Thror book. One of the things that bothers me about the book, it's not really the book's fault, but, he references the classic statistic about Indian, the size of the Indian industry at the beginning of the 18th century and then at independence. And they say look, 1701, India is a quarter of global GDP. And in 1947, it's 3%. And I'm you can't be serious and talk about that statistic. That it's so bananas. And it's bananas because you're comparing India at the apogee of its power before it disintegrates of its own forces and inertia. This is before the Brits are really involved. Mm-hmm. And then you're comparing that to a world where global GDP is a lot more equitably split across the world. Now, it is concentrated in Europe because of empire. But this is a very, and also figuring out if that 25% means anything is also another tricky thing. But is the, it's this way where I could have made John Company this game about the deindustrialization of India and been very polemical about it. But that's not true. That's, well, I mean, or even if I earnestly thought that it was true, I'm that's kind of being a little simplistic. I mean, this gets into the, you know, there's another story about it. I don't know if Thror talks about it, but there's this. I ran into this a lot when I was taking classes on post-colonial lit, where there's a story of the East India Company breaking the fingers of weavers. And it has to do with this is how they took charge of the textile industry in India and then built the Industrial Revolution, et cetera. It's not true. People have searched high and low. This definitely didn't happen, and but the fact that the story gets told is interesting, because that the telling of the story does reflect a reality that was happening that had to do with British protectionism and textiles and really like cheap cotton. And it gets, this is like the Sven Bechart Empire of Cotton stuff. Where like it was true that the Brits did huge and maybe irrevocable damage to the Indian textile industry. But it wasn't as simple as, like, someone breaking someone else's fingers. And I think Thrower's book is really good. It's really, really good. It's especially good. It's like, I love giving it to people if they, like, know nothing. Like, if you know nothing about, like, how the British Empire works, I'm like, if you're going to read one book, read Inglourious Empire. Because I would rather have you starting from that frame of reference than having read Niall Ferguson's Empire. But I also think that, like, Empire, I think Inglourious Empire is like not the last book someone should read on the subject, because it starts, it only like lightly hints at like the levels of thorniness, which is also why, I mean, when I was working on John Company, I like very explicitly, it's even, John Company is a, it's a weird game to even say it's about the British Empire, right? Because it like, in important ways, it's not. And understanding that the British Empire of like 1945 and also 1900 and also 1850 and also 1800 and 1750. These are almost different states. They behave totally differently. And I think I would love to do more British Empire games at some point, just because the other parts of the story are really interesting too. And like tracing a longer chronology. I mean, this is like the funny thing about Traffic and John Company, right? I mean, I'm going to talk about this stuff all day, but like Traffic and John Company seem like they're the same game. It's like British adventurer class goes, makes money, buys fancy hats, you know, and then comes back home. Like they both have a London season phase, right? But what was happening in China was like a very different phase than what was happening with the East India Company. And we're also looking at like state-sanctioned monopolies versus private enterprise. And we're looking at the differences between India and China, and we're looking at the differences between like 1740 and like 1820. And so like, even though there are a lot of like resonances, like they're pretty different. And so I would love to do like, you know, a game about like British policy in Africa, like a game about the Fashoda crisis or something. Right. Because just the way the British Empire is behaving in like the conference, you know, the Congress of Berlin in the 1880s and stuff is just so different from how they're behaving in India. Anyway,
it's so fascinating because I've been thinking a lot about this, having done a game about Iran in the 1950s, and then also having worked on in the past year on this design about the U.S.-Afghan war with the role of private military contractors. Because after these playtests, I'll debrief with players, and I'm kind of curious what they're getting from it, having watched them for a solid 2 hours not read flavor text from a single card, sure, have access to a rule book, and I just kind of want to know what they are. And it's like, well, it's simply this. Like when they talk about like what the U.S. war in Afghanistan was, like what the objective is, like, it's simply this. And if I have any kind of strong public reaction to anything, it's always when someone tries to simply describe something that is super fucking huge and complicated. Like, yeah. And so the Thoreau thing, like I did like the book, but I was also thinking about, you know, to your point about the size of the world, developing world economy, being related to me as a reader, like a Ross Perot pie chart that adds up to like 490% or something like that. It was a little goofy, right? Because like, well, so other economies are static and they didn't grow at all during this period. And then like, you know, there's no overall trend that we should be taking away from this. There's sort of the same thing of like how reading about incidents in India and comparing it to incidents that are happening in Afghanistan and happening in Iran, like, you know, with AIOC, there are similarities, but they're also super fucking different. Like, you know, like they're, the likelihood of, you know, an Indian worker for a company being able to get promoted, you know, in the same way that with seniority, like, you know, a European would be promoted within an English company. It's just like those paths are not the same. But Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, when it was being managed in Iran, Iranians were doing a lot of the most, you know, kind of dangerous work. Yeah. But Indians were actually being brought into Iran to act as foremen and manage Iranians. They could be trusted more in the absence of a suitable European representative, they could be trusted more to supervise the Iranians working in Anglo-Iranian oil sites, which was like very fascinating. Like they had this weird kind of like hierarchy within their own very discriminatory hiring and like, you know, promotional practices. But the idea that this is simply the same everywhere, it was just like, no, every new place they had a new way to like kind of like take in the lay of the land and see what kind of communities they were going to create. There was some consistency, but there were some inconsistencies. And so that's why you have to keep buying more books. You got to keep reading more stuff.
This reminds me, this is a thing I haven't talked about in a long time, but the Pamir expansion for Khyber Knives, the Pamir expansion Khyber Knives for the first edition, it did something kind of strange, which is it didn't introduce any new characters to the deck. And the reason why it didn't is because what I found was if people weren't reading the flavor text, and they get all these names that are in, you know, like, you know, that are in a variety of like different languages or whatever. So they don't understand, like, okay, how do I pronounce this like Dari name? Like, okay, well, I'm not going to ask anybody to try to pronounce it. I can barely do it myself. But what was happening is when someone ran into like a piece of historic knowledge that was like, this is a long name. It's like reading a long elven name in like a Lord of the Rings book, and you're like, all right, that's elf one, I guess. And so what was happening is players, where they didn't want to engage with the history because they found it was too opaque, were just sort of like saying like, oh, this is like Middle Eastern guy one, and this is like Middle Eastern guy two. And I'm like, first of all, we're not in the Middle East. This is Central Asia. But what was happening is they were like writing over the text of the game. And what I realized with Khyber Knives is I'm like, ah, the problem here is I have too many proper nouns and not enough common nouns. And so in Khyber Knives, all of the cards were like dungeon. Like I want to give you just some things that you can hold on to, because as they start more finely sketching these like slightly more common elements, they can then put in the more colorful pieces of flavor. And it was this interesting thing about Pamir, which is that some people play the game and feel like it's incredibly thematic and they feel very immersed in the story. And other people are like, I didn't know what I was doing. It was fully abstract. I think, oh, well, that's very interesting. I think part of it has to do with the nature of the game's design, but also part of it just has to do with how alien the subject is. And so you have to give players things to hold on to, which is why, like, in my non-historical games, I like straight avoid proper nouns as much as possible. I'm like, keep it in the, I like avoid proper nouns, avoid abstracts, like keep it in the realm of the absolutely concrete, because you never, a proper noun is never going to generate theme. It's never going to generate immersion. And you know, I think about like, if you read like a Shakespearean, like, you know, history play, it's like, who's this character? France. You know, he's the king of France, right, or whatever. Like, you don't worry about it. This is like, all you need to know is he was in charge of a bunch of people, right? Like, let's like get it right to the absolute core. And so you have to be, I think we always have to be very strategic about how we're presenting, and like being very aware of like the attention bandwidth of our players. And then getting to your point, like, putting all that in conversation with increasingly complex understandings of the world. I mean, that to me is, I mean, this is the heart of why I don't practice like more polemical game design, is just because I feel like the world is super complicated. And as I get older, it's even more complicated. Like, I mean, it's just, I was such a, when I started graduate school, my biggest identity was I was like a labor organizer. I was like really involved in the union movements, and I was very, very far on the left, about as far as, you know, I could put my flag as far as it could go. And I remember talking to a professor who I deeply, deeply admire this professor. And they were like, well, you know, describe your own personal philosophy, et cetera. And so I just talked about Marx for like an hour. You know, I just started spouting about like how much I liked Capital and how I was like reading Marx's letters and was really into it. And he's like, you know, don't you feel like the basic materialist assumption is wrong? Like, I literally talked for like a half an hour, and he was like, but don't you think like the materialist assumption is wrong? Like, I'm like, what do you mean? No, it all comes down to money. It's all about labor and the control of the means of production. Like, can't you not see that? And he's like, no, but like, he's like, that's not right. He's like, just, and I was like, no, are you kidding me? Like, you know, what are you talking about? I wanted to like throw like E.P. Thompson or something.
At him.
And actually, well, E.P. Thompson would be a good example we could talk about. That's a whole separate conversation. But he looked at me and he said, you know, when Marx talks about in the manifesto, maybe I think it's in the manifesto, about one of the things that capitalism does is that all that is solid melts into air. That's like Marx's beautiful phrase for it. He's like, that's a beautiful phrase, but like that's not true, because like, you know, to walk to my office, you like walk past a church. Like that's weird. That's like a 2,000-year-old institution, or maybe it's only a few hundred years old, or depending on how we want to. Mm-hmm. He's like, there's like institutions, thoughts, cultures, like modes of thinking. They have really long half-lives. And so, like, capitalism mm-hmm. might be, like, a powerful destructive force that we, like, definitely should do something about. But it's not. There's, like, a lot happening. And then when I started reading, and, like, Thompson's a good example of this, E.P. Thompson, his brilliant book on the English working class. When I started reading social historians, I was like, oh, they're paying, like, even the Marxist social historians are paying so much more reverence to, like, culture and like the weird long half-life of things. And then when you have to create a model of a world or of a conflict or of politics that gives time where time is due, all the easy arguments go away. You're like, oh no, this mm-hmm. is so much thornier. And I think American political culture is a good example of this, because like I oftentimes think it's very useful to think about transnational corporations and like the new empire and a very like Chomsky framing of understanding American interventionism, but also like I can even while I recognize the expediency of those forms, I know that like that's not really the full story. There's a lot. There's a lot going on, right? And like different, you know, like. Yeah, I don't know. This is the thing we talk about all day, but it is one of those things that, like, you know, as I read more deeply into things, I'm like, oh, everything is very complicated, and like, you don't want to, you know, confuse yourself into a position of inaction, but it does stop me from like just going on screeds.
right.
The past has more inertia, right?
Yeah, the multiple axes that like. This history rests on, and like trying to, that's why you're reading multiple things, regardless of whether it's right. outside of your era, in your era, whatever. And like the old era stuff is like typically vetted, but it's also vetted by like older people who only read old era stuff sometimes. Right. So, but there's something to still be said for like vetted, you know, like I think that you get this context. And then when I'm reading like newer things, like when I started doing the research for, my North Korea game, I read a book by Charles Armstrong called Tyranny of the Weak, and it turned out that the book was largely plagiarized and had a lot of incorrect shit in it, and I was just like, yikes. Yeah. And basically a lot of the material was taken from a historian, Blas Delantai, who was like covering, you know, kind of Korean studies and pulling a lot of things from Eastern European, you know, kind of European bloc, like countries, like their archives of the work that, like, basically folks went to North Korea during the Reconstruction post-war, and then they came back and they wrote about it, and then he's, like, going and reading what these workers' experiences were and things like that. But Armstrong's, like, just getting also wrong. But the bottom line is, like, that was the very first book, like, book number one I read on the history of North Korea, and then I just kept stacking all these things on it. Because it was a more recent thing. I was like, oh, this will be really good for me. Like, I'll definitely get, like, a really cool kind of perception of, like, what this conflict's like. And I'm reading this thing that just hadn't been adequately vetted yet. And then during the course of my research, more and more keeps coming out about how what is problematic in this book. And so it was really nice first design experience to have mm-hmm. make sure you've got like a really wide net, and you want to be reading like kind of about the same period multiple times from as many different angles as you can, till in a weird way, you know, I'm already like, when I'm reading on a subject, I think that I'm probably only retaining about 70-80% of the individual sure. book. So you just go to the next book And it's about the exact same fucking, like, decade. All right, fresh. And it's just, like, in a weird way, it's, like, it'll suddenly just, like, become a little bit more internalized, and you'll have, like, a little bit more of a sense of, like, I have, this is how the events play out, but then I'm going to also be very sensitive when the author is, like, representing something through their given ism, and they've got this, like, I go, like, oh, it's neat that this is, like, I can pull myself now from the precipice of vulgar Marxism here, because, like, I've read some of these other things, and I can sense, like, I get a whiff of it, like a fart in the car, that this is, like, not exactly, you know what I mean, the only way of viewing this particular event or this period is, like, through this given lens.
Well, there is, I mean, when I had to do my field exam in graduate school, I did something without thinking that it pleased one of my professors to no end, and it was that I organized my field list, not alphabetically, but chronologically. And it was just how it seemed like one should do it. I just didn't know what I was doing. And she looked at me and was like, she's like, this is awesome, because what you can do is you can be like, oh, I see that, like, this post-structuralist is talking to this post-structuralist is talking. And, like, you know, when you read a book of theory in the 70s, like, you should be reading it in, like, a long-collared orange button-up shirt, right? And, like, you should go to a discotheque that night. I mean, it's like, know that, like, even if they're doing, like, big, you know, galaxy brain brilliant work, they're still just, like, sitting in a particular soup. They've got a particular, like, way of thinking about it. And I read Derrida has this funny essay about the end of history, which I think he wrote in, like, the 90s. And it's one of those things when I read it, I'm like, oh, man, you're just so interested in the fall of the Soviet Union. And, like, you can really, like, misunderstand that essay by putting it in the context of, like, 2023. But just, like, let it be an object of its time a little bit, too. And I think that, like, that kind of historicization of sources is really, really, really important. And it's something that I think, you know, if we're designing history games, like, we have to do it. We have to know that, like, our understanding of the past is just so conditional. So conditional.
Our thanks to Cole Worley. I'm Dan Bullock. Outro music provided by Orchestra Polyrhythmo de Cotonou. And you can find their music and other music by Analog Africa on Bandcamp. I don't know me, mother.